Was that ant that stood up to me?
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh.
One ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this grain is a puny little ant.
Didn't that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this? You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life. It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Blast off!
I make music with my friends.
He's got a laptop. There it is. He's got a laptop.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, it's easy to do what you do when you love what you're doing, and I love Mad Science. So you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com and peopleforpeople.ning.com as well. So if you want to join in on the chat, you can jump over to either two of those chat rooms. Actually, there's quite a bit more. It's like four on Super Chat. But nonetheless, if you're on the Super Chat chat room and you want to run over there to visit the People for People radio people, nice folks over there, go down, scroll down on the Super Chat chat room and you'll see a People for People radio link. You can be in all these chats at the same time, so that's what's cool about it. So anyway, with that said, solar sunlight simulator for solar panels. You know that they have basically built solar simulators to test solar panels? And so, you know, with that said, it gets one to thinking, what would be the possibility? Because if you could actually understand exactly how the solar panel actually functions. Now, we know the explanation of how, you know, photons of light are hitting them and they're photoelectric and so on down the line. But what's really going on down inside that solar panel? You know, there's a video out there that talks about solar panels actually being LEDs. Years ago, I did a video about using an LED for a solar panel, which to me made common sense because it works one way, it works the opposite way as well. But nonetheless, I also did a video quite some time back of where I took, I called it solar-powered flashlight, and I used a tea-light candle, and lit that candle and was able to get some voltage out of the doggone solar panel. So anyway, that's kind of got me thinking about, you know, that for quite a long time. I've always been thinking about if you could actually track down the true light spectrum that solar panels work their best at. And I've tried all kinds of different types of lights and got a lot of different results. So I'm going to actually do some research into this a lot deeper and then bring that research to the table for you so you can see what's going on. But anyway, I found this one particular video, and basically this guy is using an LED and a solar panel. Of course, you know, keep in mind, take it with a grain of salt, he says that this thing is actually lighting itself, it's self-powered. Regardless of whether it's fact or fiction, there's still some plausibility to the concept. I'm just going to play this little video here.
Since I was a child, I was trying to build the self-powered light source. The idea was simple. The light bulb is generating the light. The light is illuminating the solar cell, and the solar cell is making the electricity for the light bulb. I was trying to use different types of light bulbs, different kinds of solar panels, but I did never succeed. But recently I found there is the problem, and I also found the solution. When I illuminate the cell, the light bulb is shining, but after removing the light source, it's no longer operating. The problem of this system is that the ordinary light bulb is a very inefficient source of light, so its light output is not enough to keep the solar cell operating. But recently I found the solution. Using this powerful LED, which is 10 times more efficient compared to the ordinary light bulb. Now you can see the entire system with the LED connected and directed to the solar cell. Now I am going to illuminate the cell. The solar cell is illuminated and you can see that the LED is already shining. Now I am going to remove the light source. The light source is removed, but the system keeps operating. Now I am going to stop the light from the LED. The system stopped operating. Now illuminating the solar cell again. The LED is shining. We're removing the light source. You can see the system is operating. Now making a shadow again. And the LED is not shining anymore. Once more. Illuminating. It is operating now. And making a shadow. It stopped operating. Now I am going to do this in a completely dark room.
So anyway, basically the guy takes a really efficient LED light bulb and he powers up a solar panel with a flashlight, and once that LED light bulb is going, it keeps the solar panel pushing electricity back to the light bulb. Now, of course, whether or not that's the case or not, it's still worthy of looking into deeper. Because imagine if you could simulate the sun, and you could actually track down the actual spectrum of what light actually does what as far as getting the solar panels to produce electricity, you might be able to build a super efficient system where that little system that this guy was talking about could actually be, you know, plausible to the extent of being incredibly efficient. Imagine being able to use your light, recapture some of that energy, and then be able to, you know, charge your batteries all at the same time. Now, I don't know whether or not that particular video is true or false. I mean, it looks to be plausible when you look at it, but then when you start thinking about conservation of energy, it has questions. So anyway, I'm going to start playing this one right here and give you a little bit of idea how solar panels work.
How the heck does that work? Thanks to Brilliant.org for sponsoring this episode. Hey crazies, it's time for another episode of How the Heck Does That Work? I'm sure many of you have wondered over the years, how does solar power work? Well, today's your lucky day. To help out with this, I've designed a special clone just for this video. Solar-powered clone.
20%.
Okay, maybe we'll come back to him later. First, let's get some lingo out of the way. When I say solar panel, you're probably picturing something like this. Or maybe even this. But these are called solar arrays. They're collections of solar panels. A single panel or module looks like this. And that panel is made of even smaller parts called solar cells. These cells are where the solar power comes from. Technically speaking, though, power sources don't actually provide power. They provide energy in the form of voltage, but we'll get to that later. That reminds me.
Hey, solar power club, how you doing?
30%.
Maybe he could have been designed a little better. Anyway, let's get into the structure of one of those cells. They might look like one thing, but there are several layers. A metal plate on the back, two different types of semiconductors, a metal grid on the front, an anti-reflection coating, and a piece of glass. Now, that's a lot of layers, but this is all about turning light energy into electrical energy. So let's follow the light. The first layer the light encounters is glass. Glass is an insulator, so it's not going to conduct any noticeable electricity. It's also transparent, so most of the light just passes through. The reason it's there is to keep everything else out. The other layers are kind of fragile, so that the glass protects them. Next is the anti-reflection layer. That's the layer that makes the solar cell look dark. Doesn't that mean the light never gets through? Oh no, it lets the light in. It just doesn't let it back out. Really? How does that work? This coating is so cool. Let me explain. The semiconductors underneath are a bit too shiny. If they were exposed, over 30% of the light would just reflect away. That simply won't do. If we want to use something like this on the large-scale power grid, we need it to be as efficient as possible. The glass already reflected away about 5% of the light, and we're going to lose a bunch of it to heating. We can't really afford to lose much more. The anti-reflection coating helps...
Just for a second, because... The way that the modern-day solar panel is put together, and he's talking about how you could lose some of it to the heating as far as inefficiency, imagine if you took the Peltier element, which is a thermoelectric device that works off of a temperature different using the Seebeck effect, and it actually produces electricity. So you could take these solar panels and monopolize on not just the, you know, the light spectrum portion of it, but also the temperature of it as well, making these solar panels yet even more efficient. Just keep moving.
Let's just hold on to what we've got left. And it works like this. You can't just coat it black. Otherwise, all the light would heat the cell, and you wouldn't get any electricity. This coating has to be transparent. It must let the light pass through. But what happens is you get a reflection off the top and the bottom. If the coating is just the right thickness, the tube will cancel, and the reflected light disappears, leaving only the incoming light. All of it? Unfortunately, no, but most of it. The amount of cancellation is wavelength dependent, but it's the best we can do. So both the glass and the anti-reflection coating solve some practical issues. But you're not here for practical issues. You probably want to hear how a solar cell actually generates electricity. That's where semiconductors come in, Terry Lee. The best one we've got is silicon, right in the middle of the chart. Full insulators won't work because the jump to the conduction band is too big. Conductors won't work because they're already conductive. We want the incoming light to make it conductive. Semiconductors need a boost to become conductive, but only a small one. A little visible light will be just enough. There's a slight itty-bitty obstacle for us, though. Silicon is 4 from the left on the periodic table. 1, 2, 3, 4. That means each silicon atom only has 4 electrons in the valence band, all 4 of which get used up when they bond to each other in the semiconductor. The incoming light might break some of those loose, but it's not enough. Solar-powered clone knows exactly what I mean.
65%?
Man, I really should have pre-energized him first. Anyway, pure silicon isn't going to be enough. We need to enhance it using a process called doping. Well, yeah, kind of like that. We are technically injecting something that doesn't belong to enhance performance. But unlike sports doping, this is totally legal. Where was I? Right, enhancements. We need extra electrons that aren't part of a bond. The number of valence electrons is equal to how many columns over we are. So we just need to step over one more column to phosphorus. That's 4 electrons for bonding and 1 extra for us to move around. We still want this to be mostly silicon, but if we mix in some phosphorus, we get some spare unbonded electrons to work with. The incoming light can excite those electrons up to the conduction level, but that's not going to do us any good if we don't have anywhere for them to go. One step to the left of silicon, there are only 3 valence electrons. That gives us a hole, or opening, that our extra electrons will want to fill. Unfortunately, the aluminum atoms are a little too big to fit inside the silicon, so we take one step up to boron instead. They'll fit quite nicely in the silicon, and leave us some electron holes to work with. The two of them together are the key to how a solar cell works. Separate, the two types of silicon are neutral. There's no net charge on either one. But the moment the phosphorus-doped silicon touches the boron-doped silicon, there's a mad rush of electrons from the phosphorus to the boron at the boundary. This creates an imbalance of charge inside the solar cell. Some of the phosphorus are now positively charged because they're missing electrons. And some of the boron are negatively charged because they have extras. Any imbalance of charge will give us an electric field, or more importantly for circuits, it will give us a voltage, which is just an amount of energy per unit charge. When more electrons are ready to move, the voltage tells them which way to go. Pretty quickly, that initial rush of electrons forms a barrier between the two sides. They reach an equilibrium and stop flowing. They'll only move again if we give them the energy to move. Energy from incoming light. We just need a couple of conductors to connect the silicon to a circuit, and bam, you've got yourself a solar cell. Why is the top one shaped like a grid? Oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense, I promise. The back conductor is a full plate, but the front conductor has to leave some space. Not enough space, and the light can't get through to the silicon. Too much space, and the electrons have to travel too far along the silicon. The grid pattern is a happy medium between the two. A happy little conductor. I'm such a dork. So, the silicon pair separates charge and gives us a voltage. But the voltage of an individual solar cell isn't actually that high. It's only about 0.5 volt. For comparison, a AA battery provides 1.5 volts. And a wall socket in the US provides 120 volts, give or take. If we want to use solar cells in the power grid, we need a lot of cells in a panel, and a lot of panels in an array. Of course, there are other obstacles to consider, too. Solar cells only provide DC, so we have to convert it to AC. But that's not really a problem with one of these. Sunlight can vary from moment to moment or place to place, so we need an adequate storage device. But we have those. They're called batteries and capacitors. Why use carbon fuels that mess up our atmosphere and ocean when we have a giant nuclear furnace releasing a seemingly endless supply of light energy? It's 1,000 watts of power for every square meter of Earth. We should be taking advantage. So are you ever going to look at solar panels the same way again? Let us know in the comments. Thanks for liking and sharing this video. Don't forget to subscribe if you'd like to keep up with us. And until next time, remember, it's okay to be a little crazy. Okay, I'm ready. Dude, I just finished. Are you interested in solar energy?
Alright, so anyway, that gives you a general idea according to what the book says and all that kind of stuff. But did you know that you could actually use LEDs, like I said earlier, for solar panels? There's a guy that does a little test on them.
Hello, Tubers. Mescal here. I've been thinking about these little panels here and what kind of voltage they'd put out in the sun. Cool white, warm white. Now what's going on here is light from the sun is hitting the phosphor. The phosphor is re-emitting light, and then that light gets picked up by the junctions, the semiconductor junctions that are laid out in a grid there. So, as a solar panel, it does work. And looking at the voltage here, I'm seeing 7.99, nearly 8 volts off the cool white. And I would expect a higher voltage off this one because it would convert more of the ultraviolet wavelength, because it's blue light that hits the phosphor from below and converts it into white light. So the reverse is happening here, whereas ultraviolet light from the sun that normally wouldn't be caught by a solar panel is being converted. This is a technique that has been used in some very high efficiency solar panels where they're catching more than just the light that, what do we see there, 8 point, giving some trouble here with the continuity. I made a bad connection there with the solder joint. 8.38. So it's holding true to the theory. We're getting more voltage because the warm white will convert more. Anyway, just thought I'd show you that. Thanks for watching. Don't forget to rate, comment, and subscribe if you haven't already. Hit the bell if you're a new subscriber if you want to get notifications. Yibbity yibbity blah blah blah. Thanks for watching. Bye.
Anyway, the reason why I threw that particular one is because he had two separate LEDs, high-efficiency LEDs, but they were made slightly different. And so you could see there was an obvious difference in the amount of voltage coming out of each one of these when they were in direct sunlight. So the more you could learn about the light spectrums and different types of materials, you would have the capability of being able to produce some really super efficient solar panels that would convert that light energy to electricity a lot better. And so when you get back to what I was talking about earlier about the guy that put the solar panel and the LED together and energized the solar panel and got the LED to light up, and then the LED keeps the solar panel maintained while it's going. Once again, I haven't tested that particular deal, so I couldn't say whether or not it's plausible or not. But if you go down and read some of the comments in there, there's so many people that are so close-minded about potential possibilities of that type of concept of getting a self-running solar panel that, it's just mind-blowing. But, if you've been listening to Mad Science, I don't discount anything. Even a video that might have the potential being, not so much on the up and up, maybe a hidden battery in there. And to the extent, even if it had a hidden battery in there, but you could get this solar panel to at least take some of that energy back and charge that battery back up, then at the very least, you just made that solar panel more efficient by adding that battery. So the by itself, it might not run very long at all, if at all, with just the solar panel and the LED by itself. It might cancel itself out too much, take too much power, whatever. But if you threw that battery on there, and you could get that battery to maintain that light bulb, and some of that energy comes back. I hope you understand what I'm saying. You make that solar panel more efficient while still using the light, so the light would last a little bit longer than it would prior. So anyway, with that said, while doing research into different stuff like this, I come across a deal that Laser Saber did where he pretty much had something similar concept where the solar panel was actually taking some of that charge back by using the lighting system. But he built an all-in-one inverter and a system where it's all slimline, everything's built into the panel itself. And so I'll play this one right here for you too.
Okay, so what you see here is a Sol-in-1. I'm really excited about this this project. This is something I've come up with to try to make alternative energy easy. In fact, idiot-proof easy. And it works great. I've been testing this for a long time. Before I posted any videos on this, I wanted to do a lot of testing. I was actually trying to figure out what I should do with this. I was very tempted to market this and different things. And while that was always an idea in my head, I finally decided to just share this freely. This and the links to all the parts I used to build this will be on laserhacker.com. I'll be discussing this on laserhackerforum.com. I put up a forum there. The Sol-in-1 project is something that I think we could get a lot of energy behind and build up a lot of these units, source the parts, bring the price down. Let me just turn this radio down here a little bit. Bring the cost of these down, although even now they're quite attractive in price, and you'll see that when I get the price list up on my website. But you can see I've got an AC fan here running, all these AC lights, charging my iPad. I got a 2-amp USB, and all coming off this one little solar panel here. So that's a quick overview of the Sol-in-1. One of the main features that makes the Sol-in-1 unique is everything that you need all in one, and then a single on and off switch. And this particular unit, I have two on and off switches. I have a jewel ringer here, as well as an AC inverter, as well as a 2-amp USB. And I'll show you a little overview here. So here's the panel itself, and you can see that everything needed for this is actually slimmed down and put into the panel itself. I got the AC plug right here on the side. I got the slimline inverter and the plug for the jewel ringer right there. You can see I got the transistor for the jewel ringer on the aluminum frame of the panel. That makes a great heatsink. So what I've got here is I've got 20 amp hours of a battery right here. These are lithium iron phosphate batteries. They're again, 20 amp hours right here at about 14 volts. So just a tremendous amount of watt hours that this thing can deliver. And then what I've got here is I've got a battery balancer circuit. This circuit keeps each cell balanced so that one cell doesn't come up on over voltage or one discharge too far. Coming off from that, I've got a solar charger unit that takes the energy from the sun, charges all of this. It also controls the power coming to the inverter. So this allows me to have a single on and off switch for the whole device. And that's the idea here. We want to make alternative energy easy. For too long, alternative energy has been a very mysterious thing. People have a hard time matching the batteries to the inverter, to the solar panel, to all these different systems. So with a system like this, we can actually make it very easy for the end user. So you basically have a single on and off switch that activates the whole thing. If you leave this on too long, low voltage detection shuts down the load. The breeze from the fan's kind of cool. So yeah, if you leave this on too long, a low voltage protection shuts down all this load. If you leave this in the sun too long, the over voltage protection kicks in and keeps these batteries from overcharging. So I've got my 2-amp USB here for charging devices. You can see I've got more room here. I could put more battery capacity. That's what really amazes me. When I first decided to build one of these, the challenge in my mind was, can we actually get everything we need for an all-in-one system into the profile of a regular solar panel. This is a 20-watt solar panel. You know, can I get a 20-amp-hour battery, an inverter, a jewel ringer, a charge, solar charge controller, all of that stuff fit down in a slim solar panel like this? And you can see that, yes, it is possible. We can do that, and when you do that, you create something that, to the alternative energy world, is kind of like the iPad is to computers. I think this right here could change alternative energy. Just as the iPad experience has changed computers for many people. It's made computers simple and easy to use. That's the same concept we have going on here. I think this particular project is what could really get alternative energy and solar recognized. So we named this Sol-in-1. Obviously, I'm giving this away freely for anybody to build and to use, and I would hope that these could be put into use all over the world. You could put something like this in a closet, and when you have an earthquake or a tsunami or a tornado come through, such as I have, you can just pull this out of the closet. These lithium iron phosphate batteries will hold a charge for a very long time, I mean years. They also have thousands of charge-discharge cycles, so this is great. You can set this in the sun, point it at a window. You can see here on the back, there's these two lights. The light here on the left means the unit's charging. So that's what we got going on there. You can see that the blinking light means that it is actually charging. So right now we're actually charging from the lights right there. It's actually charging this unit. So let me just turn some of this off, and I'll show you guys the jewel ringer functionality of this device.
We'll pause that for a second in case you missed it. When he was holding it up and he was showing the charge controller lights in the back, you could see when he faced that solar panel towards that array of lights that he's got there, it was actually charging that solar panel. So it's an all-in-one system that Laser Hacker did, or Laser Saber. He's got a website called laserhacker.com. Those links also are posted in the Super Chat room, I believe. Let me take a peek, make sure I'm not saying that and they're not there. I know that they're on the website. So anyway, I don't see them on the Super Chat room, but either way, laserhacker.com, check them out. He does all kinds of good stuff. Anyway, I just wanted to point out though that whenever he took that unit and aimed it towards the lights, that he was running with the same unit, you could see the charge light came on, so it was actually charging.
Right now I have the jewel ringer circuit set up separately from the inverter, so I'm going to power down the inverter, and we're going to run the jewel ringer. You can see the jewel ringers in the device right here. So by separating these two, right now I have two switches. Again, I want this to be a super easy to use device. One of the things I think that should define a Sol-in-1 is a single switch. So this is a prototype. I do have a plan to make this whole device run on a single switch. I think we should have some target goals for something that we call a Sol-in-1. Easy to use would be one of the number one goals, and everything should strive to make this as easy as possible to use. These need to be put into action anywhere in the world, and people don't need to be worried about all the complexities of solar and alternative energy that they've had to worry about in the past. You basically set this thing in the sun, it charges, you connect a load, you run the load, you run it too long with too much of a load, its safety shuts off, put it in the sun the next day, it charges. Just, again, super simple and easy to use. But in this case, I have the jewel ringer here coming directly off the battery load. The battery balancer here will shut down the jewel ringer if it gets low voltage on the batteries. But by having the jewel ringer set up like that, we can run a load off the jewel ringer at 200 to 300 milliamps, which again is the beauty of the jewel ringer, because this little inverter takes 200 to 300 milliamps just to run in idle mode. And that's the whole beauty of the jewel ringer circuit, as all of us who have been experimenting with those know. So, here we got a jewel ringer light. So we're running this light right here for the amount of energy it takes me just to run this inverter. And that's the beauty of putting a jewel ringer in a Sol-in-1 device like this. Now that we have the jewel ringer in there, you could have this in the house, in just a single bedroom or something, and only be pulling 200 to 300 milliamps, and with a 20 amp hour battery supply, at 13.7-14 volts. That light there is going to run a very long time, folks.
All right, so basically he's got a jewel ringer circuit in there. You'll have to look up that. Maybe I'll try to do a show on it later, but it's a super efficient deal where he's actually running this LED lighting lighting system using that particular circuit, which makes it yet even more efficient, and you could get this thing to run a lot longer for one light bulb for a less amount of power input. And so the point I'm trying to get to with that is that if you could actually get this thing to charge from that particular light spectrum, then what the guy was showing earlier in that video where he claims that he was able to get the solar panel and the LED to run itself once he energized it with the flashlight that he used, then you could do the same thing with this type of panel right here. You could get this thing to charge itself. Now, of course, once again, conservation of energy, they're going to try to say that's not possible. But I don't care about what they say. What I'm saying is, until people test it and, do the research on it, then you're not going to know. And regardless, even if you get this thing to just last longer as far as keeping charged by recapturing some of that energy, then it's no longer wasted energy that you're actually you're recapturing that. And any heat from the system, when you add other aspects like the Peltier elements that work off the Seebeck effect, one side hot, the other side cold, it will constantly push electricity out. Could be added to that same system so that any heat source, any temperature difference would constantly put power to it as well. So it's like this. I keep talking about people, why everybody thinks, if you just take one single concept by itself, it might not be enough to run what you need. But imagine if you had a wind turbine outside and it was also connected to that. So whether it was dark outside or not, you're still pushing power to the system. That's what my Free Thinkers video series was all about. Was it was taking multiple sources of energy, including radio waves, and it was pushing power to the battery banks and to the capacitor banks to store that energy. It was using galvanic action, it was using solar power, it was using wind power, it was using thermal electrics, and it was using just about everything you could possibly imagine, all in one system. And up until here recently, that thing ran for several years under just the power that it was being provided in all different directions, all different types of energy. And so if you want to make a super efficient system, then you combine all these technologies together in order to get it. And so with that said, using thermoelectrics, not just the fact that a change in the heat into electricity, but, like molten salt reactors where they heat up the salt during the day and they use that heat during the night to run steam turbines, which produce electricity. So there's all kinds of possibilities. Let's keep going with this.
On this jewel ringer part of the circuit. And of course, as you know, with the jewel ringer, we can plug in other types of lights. Can plug in multiple LED bulbs like this. So, fully functional jewel ringer there, right on the device. Okay, just to show that the jewel ringer part of the circuit can put out a serious amount of light. Check this out. This is a really big LED light. Let me just see what the specs here on this thing real quick. This particular light here is 885 lumens, 18 watt LED light. Lowe's had this on sale the other day. But I'm going to plug this light into the jewel ringer portion of the circuit. And look at that, folks. Oh, that is blindingly bright light right there. And what a beautiful thing to see the thin profile of this solar panel. And you've seen the overview, so you know the capability that's in this little panel right here.
Let me pause this for a second so I can answer a question in the chat room. Christopher Maresh said, is it still running? And no, because I actually dismantled the doggone system because somebody, for whatever purposes, decided to cut one of the wires. And the concept of the particular test was to see how long that this thing could run. If you go back and you look at the very first video, then you'll see the beginning date of the experiment. And then just here recently, I finally dismantled it because once that wire was cut that was, basically charging the batteries, I don't know whether it was an accident or on purpose, but nonetheless, it did get cut. So if I would have started it back up, then that means all those years, I'm starting over as far as being able to tell somebody this is how long this thing ran and so on down the line. So I'm going to do a better system than that. I'm going to take every single thing that was in the Free Thinkers video and every single thing that you've been listening to me talk about for a long time and combine them all into one system. So that no matter what's going on outside, using everything from thermoelectrics to piezoelectrics to negative ion generation, static electricity, galvanic action, Seebeck effect, using like Peltier elements and thermocouples and thermopiles, wind power, solar power, and even earth battery technology to show that no matter what is going on in your environment, there's more than enough energy to continuously keep things running. And the best thing that we've got going for us as far as alternative energy is the fact that you can get transistors, MOSFETs, and things like that to switch on and off power sources to pulse coils. So imagine if I can take like a Slayer exciter circuit, which takes a TIP42C transistor, a diode, and a resistor, and it pulses a primary, basically the equivalence of a Tesla coil, and then sends out wireless energy. Well, I can do that with a 9-volt battery. So all I have to do is basically come up with the equivalence of what a 9-volt battery is capable of. That's current watts, amps, and voltage all together. And so it's so ridiculously easy to come up with 9 volts. That's why every single system that you hear me talking about, I base it off of a 12-volt system, anywhere from 9 volts to 12 volts, because anybody can come up with a car battery, and an old car battery, or even build the equivalents of. So with that said, that's not very much power that you have to worry about trying to get. So let's keep going here.
Okay, what makes a Solin 1? My vision for the Solin 1 is that if we build these things, and again, I want to give this idea away freely at this point, and if we build these things and name this, if we make a thread on the internet somewhere, post a YouTube video, you don't have to do this, obviously. I'm giving this away freely, but my request to people in the alternative energy community would be to call a device like this a Solin 1. And I think we'll build momentum. I think this will start to avalanche. I put up a forum on laserhacker.com. I plan on making a thread there. I can't keep up with all the forums on the internet and all the information that's going on there, but I'm going to try to put more energy into answering people's questions and being active on the forum that I put up. And on that forum, we can build some momentum behind this. We can spec parts. We can find cheaper sources for these lithium iron phosphate batteries. If we find an inverter that works better, whatever it is, we can keep the momentum going on this. We can build these. We can send these out to missions. We can give these to friends. I've got friends that live off the grid. We can get energy and momentum building up behind this. And the reason this will take off, when a lot of solar products haven't taken off in the past, is the simplicity. People love easy. And solar up until this point, if you ask me, has been hard. I've seen other products on the market, and they always have a panel, an external inverter, an external battery pack, or just all types of complexity. You can throw this in the back of a backpack frame on a hiking trip, and it will charge as you're hiking, and you'll have power in the evening at your tent. I've taken this on camping trips. You know, I've treated this thing pretty harsh. I'll leave this thing out in my metal rooftop for weeks on end, through rain, through everything else. And I haven't tried to waterproof this or anything, but I'm just doing hard testing on this device because I want to see how this thing's going to hold up. And, you know, maybe the heat from the sun will keep our charge-discharge cycles down a little bit and these lithium iron phosphate batteries. Time will tell. But let's get some momentum behind this. I really think if we bring this type of a concept to the world, I think alternative energy will just take off. So join me on Laser Hacker Forum. I will post updates and links. This is a rather crude first prototype, so expect version 2 of this to look a whole lot nicer in the looks of the device itself. But anyway, that's it. Let's all keep experimenting. So I thought I should just give a quick overview of the specs that are inside this device. I've got 20 amp hours of a battery pack. I've got a 200 watt AC inverter. I've got a 2 amp USB. And I've got a jewel ringer. And it's all built into this Solin-1 device.
Yeah, for supposedly a crude-looking device, I think it looks pretty good. I'd like to have a bunch of those things. Really nice, nicely put together. Of course, Laser Saver always does do pretty good work. So anyway, basically, the concept of the guy running the solar panel by itself, I think, is possible. Now, that might sound contrary to the conservation of energy, but yet nonetheless, if you can throw an imbalance on anything, you can get things to continuously produce electricity. And we have that capability because of the materials and the types of transistors and MOSFETs and even 555 timers that we got. If you could pull enough power to run that, to pulse coil systems, you can change that into power that can be used to run those lighting systems ridiculously easy without near the amount of current that you would have to have otherwise to run them. And you've seen in a lot of the videos in the past that I did where you can actually hold up LEDs with your finger and pick up radiant energy off the Tesla coil, and it will actually light that doggone LED up. And plus, I've had a whole bunch of other wireless circuits that I showed in videos as well that store energy in capacitors, and even after you shut the thing off, they actually keep on going. And so, you know, with that said, making wireless circuits like the Slayer Exciter circuit, and not just making one, but making multiples of them so that every time a capacitor comes fully charged, it will trip that deal and pulse a coil, sending another wave down the line and keep moving that energy constantly, then you can see why I would say that I believe it's fully possible for this guy to be able to do what he's doing. So anyway, I'm going to play another podcast where this guy is explaining on how solar panels work, because this one here, if we can get into the right light spectrum, if we can find out whether the solar panels are partially thermal and partially photovoltaic, or for whichever light spectrum is actually causing the effect that you get. And this guy tests all different types of solar panels, because all solar panels are not created equally. some of them are more efficient than others, and some of them are made out of different types of material than others. But he tests the light spectrum to build like a solar simulator, to actually solar sunlight simulator for testing solar panels. So let's start with this.
Hey YouTubers, and welcome to this video on how solar panels work.
Now, I just want to warn you up front that this video series is going to be a little adventure and journey, a learning journey, in terms of my path to getting to create a solar simulator for testing solar panels. So some of you will have known I've played around with grow lights to do indoor testing of solar panels, and that's thrown up a few interesting technical challenges, and I've had to go away and do a lot of research, a lot of reading, talking to people. Fortunately, I've been able to talk to people at companies who produce solar panels and some folks from NASA as well. Now, even though I've done a lot of reading and talking to folks, there is a lot of technical information. It's very easy to get the finer details wrong. I'm hoping I get most of it right. But for the most part, I think you'll walk away from this and you'll get a good high-level understanding, especially of what various parts of the spectrum or light spectrum can do to various materials. And this becomes important because various solar panels will react differently or produce their power and are more sensitive to different parts of the spectrum. Some are more sensitive to the visual light that we can see. Some have got a greater sensitivity towards infrared. I've been playing around with some LEDs, some cheaper LEDs, and then some more expensive LEDs to try and create as close as possible a representation of the spectrum that we get from natural sunlight. But anyway, through this journey...
I want to pause this for a second. Also, I didn't mention that I want to try not just different light spectrums with these next experiments that I want to be doing, but I also want to do radiant energy experiments such as with Tesla coils and Slayer exciter circuits to see whether or not these will also pick up radiant energy, not just in the visible light spectrum.
We're going to understand how these work. We're going to do various tests and experiments, and this will also end up with me finishing the build of my simulator. Right, so before we dive down into the detail at an atomic level, because it's important to understand what happens at an atomic level, because that's where we really get an understanding of light sensitivity across various materials. What I'll do is I'll quickly explain the challenges that I face in building this sunlight simulator in order to test solar panels indoors. So I'm very fortunate. I've got a spectrometer, so I can point this at various light sources and take measurements to see measure light intensity and then to see the spectrum that light is putting out within a certain spectrum band. I've gone and published a lot of these results on my website, so people who are interested to see, let's say, what a halogen light or various LED lights, grow lights, the sunlight, or what have you, you can go and have a look at that and see the various spectrum of those lights. Why is that important to some people, understanding the spectrum that comes out from various lights? Well, particularly people who do photography and videography, they want to try and create as best as possible natural colors that you'd see under normal sunlight. And with artificial lights, that becomes a problem because you don't get the proper color rendering index, the CRI. And that's where having the kind of right spectrum transmitted from a light source helps with getting good colors. But for me, it gets more detailed because I want to test solar panels. So this is what the spectrum looks like from the sun outside. Now, this represents the various bands of light. As you can see, it looks like a rainbow. If you see light being split up by a prism or rain in the sky forming a rainbow, you then get the light being split up into the spectrum, the visual spectrum that you can see. And we get down from around, we can see at around 400 nanometers. That's the wavelength of the light. So that's just at the top end of UV or ultraviolet. And then we start moving into the blues, greens, yellows, red, where we start getting to around 700 nanometers, and above 700 nanometers we start moving into infrared. And that goes all the way up to like 1,800, 2,000 nanometers. Now the problem that I face with my kind of indoor grow light is that that is what the spectrum looks like. As you can see, that looks vastly different from the nice broad spread that you get from the sun. It's very peaky. You can see we get a peak here just around the UV and the blue area over here, and it kind of moves up into the yellows, and then we get a big peak around the reds and then some infrared, and then it drops off. Now, have I been able to test solar panels with this and simulate the power that you can get outdoors with this light indoors?
Certainly, yes, I can. In fact, all you need to do is calibrate the level of the light, and what you're doing, you're calibrating the light intensity, and ultimately when you're calibrating the intensity, it's the number of photons which is coming off and hitting the material in the solar panel. And by doing that, I can get the same level of power out of a solar panel indoors that I would outdoors. So I can use it to test solar panels. However, the catch is that is kind of calibrated for one particular type of material. So for instance, I can go and test monocrystalline and polycrystalline lights under that and get exactly the same results that I would outside as inside at that specific level or light intensity. But when I go and perhaps put an amorphous solar panel underneath there, or even one of these, and this is very interesting, this is also a monocrystalline panel, but it's the SunPower cell, and SunPower have got their own proprietary way of making solar panels. And their proprietary method means that the makeup is slightly different. And if I go and stick it under there where I've calibrated for normal mono or polycrystalline panels, I don't get the same readings that I would outdoors. And that's a challenge. And through my research, what I've discovered is, for one, amorphous panels are way off. They are far more sensitive to the visual light spectrum, so they will produce far more power underneath a light like that than if you put it side by side with a mono or poly outside. And the company that I spoke to, who went and produced their own sunlight simulator indoors, they suffer with the same issues. A lot of the simulators are there set up for mono and polycrystalline panels, whereas if you're producing amorphous panels, many of those simulators, the standards which are set up don't cater for the light for that. And so you're going to get misreadings, and you have to do a lot of calibration to get the same readings you need to test an amorphous panel for what you're going to get outdoors. Now, I've managed to get far closer, so let me just show you here. This spectrum is what I've managed to achieve using some very high quality Cree LEDs and UG LEDs. And in fact, if you look closely here, you're going to see there's a big spike on the UV side. So during my testing, when I was playing around, I realized I was getting a far better spread of the spectrum, but I was missing out some of the UV. So I just got a UV light and plonked it in there. But I ultimately need to fill this gap. If we go back to the sun spectrum, you can see I'm still a fair way off what the sun is actually producing. But this was achieved with very minimal tuning and playing around. So I'm hoping that ultimately if I play around with some lenses and filters, and if I'm able to vary the intensity of the various parts of the spectrum, I can get fairly close. Now, I don't need an exact representation of the sun. And in fact, you don't want an exact representation of the sun, because the sun actually varies throughout the year, throughout the day, different parts of the world. So you want a kind of model standard which can be used across all around the world for people doing testing and across various solar panel technologies. But there is the catch. Even the folks at NASA say they have to calibrate their testers for various different technologies. But anyway, let's go and understand the photoelectric effect and how solar panels work. Now, in order to understand how a solar panel can generate electricity or a flow of charge by merely light hitting it, we need to go down to the atomic level. Now, ultimately, you don't have to get too caught up with this. It's just interesting to understand what happens at that level. But we're going to come back to, I'll pull you out of that, pull you out of the weeds. I do have an analogy, hopefully, which will help the explanation as well. Now, if we look at an atom, and at this point in time, we're not going to talk about a specific atom. We are going to, in particular, going to talk about silicon, because that's what most solar panels are made out of. Now, you'll have an atom, and at its nucleus, it's got protons, and then you've got bands of electrons flowing around the protons, and that's your atom. And various different materials are going to have a different number of protons and electrons. And if you look at the periodic table, you can actually see those numbers to understand that. But now, the important thing for us is the outer band of electrons is called the valence band. And for us, we want to understand when a material is an insulator, a semiconductor, or a conductor. Now, to understand that, a material becomes a conductor when the valence electrons are able to flow in what is called the conductance band. And for those electrons to move up from the valence band to the conductance band means they need a certain amount of energy to pop them up to that level. Now, in materials which are conductors, their band gap or energy band is very small. They don't need a lot of energy. In fact, the valence and conductance bands sometimes overlap. So things like gold and copper, they are going to conduct straight away. Semiconductors, on the other hand, have a gap between the conductance and valence band. And these electrons are required to be given a kick. They need a specific energy in them to jump up from the valence band to the conductance band. And that energy level is measured in electron volts, or e-volts. Now, for insulators, that band gap is very big, and that's why insulators are insulators. But that the one interesting thing to note is that band gap can vary with temperature. And that becomes interesting, certainly once we start looking at the effects of heat on a solar panel. Now, if we talk about the specific material which a lot of solar panels are made up from, and that's silicon, that is a band gap between the valence band and the conductance band of 1.1 electron volts, and that's at normal room temperature. As I said, that varies with temperature. So in order to kick an electron from the valence band to the conductance band to give you a chance to have charge flow, you need that energy, a specific energy, to kick it up there. Now, the sun is emitting light photons.
I'm going to pause that for a second again. When he's talking about temperature on those things, if there's a sweet spot in the temperature of that solar panel, you can actually drain off some of that that heat to, say, like a Peltier element, and be, with a temperature difference, basically be using that to draw that heat energy away and bringing the temperature of the solar panel down, yet making it more efficient. So using a Peltier element with a heat sink on the opposite side, imagine you got your solar panel, you got a Peltier element, you got a heat sink, and then you got the open atmosphere up behind there. So now whatever temperature that solar panel is actually making is being pulled away from the process through the Peltier element, and because of the temperature difference on both sides of this thing, you actually generate electricity. So you, by combining these two technologies together, you benefit the one by being able to pull some of that heat away and keeping it at that sweet spot of the temperature, and then you're actually producing electricity, which would have otherwise been a hindrance to the system or wasted energy, so to speak. So let's keep rolling here.
And photons are coming down from the sun, and depending on the various bands or the various parts of the spectrum, those photons have various energy levels. Down at the UV end, they've got more energy. Their electron volt level can be as high as, let's say, 3.94 electron volts. Whereas once you start getting to red infrared, it's more like 1.11 electron volt. So if you had, let's say, for instance, a photon with an energy of half an electron volt hit a piece of silicon, it won't be able to dislodge or move the electron from the valence band to the conductance band. But once you get a photon which has got about 1.1 volt of energy hitting it, it can dislodge that electron into the conductance band. Now, the story doesn't stop there. So once you've gone and dislodged that electron, the hope is that we can then use that electron will go and flow and we've got energy. The problem is if there's nothing to take it out, like a charge, to attract it away from the conductance band, that electron is merely going to fall back from the conductance band, release energy, and go back to the valence band. So you need a charge there. Now, what you could do is actually add a potential difference. You could do that by adding a cell or a battery. So if you create a charge, when you get the electron knocked out and going up there, that charge will then draw it out so that it can then conduct away. I would liken this to like a well of water. Your band gap is the depth of the well. You've got water at the bottom of the well and you've got a bucket. So you go, you've got the bucket and you require a certain amount of energy to pull the water out the well and you've got it to the top of the well. Now, at the top of the well, on the side of the well, we've got this trough or pipe where we can pour the bucket in, and then we get a flow of water which can go and do work, can turn a paddle or do work for us. Now, the problem is shifting that bucket from the center of the well off to the side to go and tip the water out. And that's the same thing with the atomic model that I've just spoken about. So you've got to pull it up, and if you don't have anything to grab the bucket and tip the water out, it's merely going to fall back to the bottom of the well. So that's what that charge is like to you, is to grabbing that bucket and tipping it out for us. Now, we don't need a cell or a battery in a solar panel to do that. We do that in another way by combining two silicon layers which have been doped. So what is doping? Doping is merely adding an impurity to both levels to give them a specific charge. They'll typically use something like boron or phosphorus, and one will have an extra electron, one will have one fewer electron, so it'll have a hole. So one will have a net positive charge, one will have a net negative charge. And when you pull those together, you then create a PN junction. And a PN junction, you've probably heard from things like transistors or diodes. And when you've got that PN junction, what you have is you have some electrons going from one side to the other, and you end up with something called a depletion zone right at that junction. And what that does for us, it creates a charge for us. And it's that charge that's created by bringing these two silicon materials which have been doped together, create their own little static charge, which means that when you get electrons kicked out of the one material from photons from the sun, they don't simply fall back, they go up to the conductance band, and there's a charge which then can send them on their way to generate electricity for us. So let's have a closer look at this sketch. Now, if you have a look at this diagram that I've got here, this kind of represents what I've been talking about. So we've got our valence band over here, which has got the outer electrons, and then up here we've got the conductance band. And in order to get your electrons to jump across that gap, your band gap or your energy gap of your material, let's say your silicon material, you need a photon to come in, and at a certain wavelength it's going to have a specific energy to be able to kick out one of those electrons up into this conductance band. So as an example here, I mean, I've got, let's say, at 500 nanometers we've got some light coming in. And let's say that's got an energy of 2.4 electron volts. Now, that's more than we need. So something interesting is going to be played out here, and I'm going to try and demonstrate in the demonstration a little later. So if we have more energy than we need, does it work? Yes. Do we get extra electricity or energy? No, we don't. That extra energy that we have gets dissipated in heat, which ultimately doesn't help us. But still, it's more than enough energy for, let's say, silicon, which only needs 1.1 electron volts to kick it out from the valence band to the conductance band. Now, as noted, once you get to the conductance band, it needs that charge to be able to move off and then flow, let's say, in a conductor as electricity and to do some work for us. So on the top here, this very thin green layer, this would be on the top of your solar panel. So on your solar panel, you're going to have a metal backing underneath, and that acts as, let's say, your positive conductor. Now, I'm saying it's a positive conductor, but various manufacturers can change this, and we're going to talk about this in particular when we get to the sun power cells. But you're going to have a metal backing underneath, which acts as structural support and your back conductor, positive conductor. On top of that, you're going to have your P-type silicon material, and then you're going to have your N-type as a very thin layer on the top of your solar panel. It's a very thin coating so that the sun can penetrate that, the photons can do their work, and then you're going to have your electrons popping out and traversing across that junction, and then on the top of that junction, you're going to have little metal fingers picking up those electrons. That's your negative terminal, and allowing them to flow away. And that's what we've got here. And when you have your electrons flowing round in this way, that's going to be your energy or your charge flow, and that's our electricity doing work for us. So now, a few interesting things to note. If you want more electrons to pop out and create more charge, that's more current, you're going to need more photons. And that equates to the brightness of the sun, or the intensity. So it's the intensity of the light for a unit area. So the higher the intensity of your light, you're going to have more photons, and that is going to cause more electrons to be kicked out from the valence band to the conductance band, and more electricity is going to flow. And just like if we have a solar panel outside in the sunlight, when you've got low light, you get less power from your solar panel. And when you've got more light intensity, potentially you're going to have more energy. Now, it's not as simple as that. There are going to be things like heat, which also have an impact, the temperature of the solar panel. But at a very simple level, that is what's happening. If we take a look at this graph on the side here, on the y-axis, that is the intensity of the light. So again, the higher the intensity, the more photons you've got. And then over here, we've got the wavelength of the light measured in nanometers. And I've got it all the way from 300 nanometers, which will be into your UV or your ultraviolet, going up to, let's say, 900 nanometers. Now, the part, as I said, that we can see, the viewable, which is viewable to the eye, is between about 400 and roughly 700 nanometers. Now, for the most part, a lot of the energy contained to drive solar panels is in this viewable area. But certainly for monocrystalline and polycrystalline panels, there's a fair part of that goes into the UV spectrum. Whereas for amorphous panels, it goes down into the blues and the UV part of the spectrum. So that poses quite an interesting thing, because generally speaking, monocrystalline and polycrystalline panels are far more efficient at producing energy than amorphous panels. And this might actually explain that. But on this graph, I've got a little black line here, and that is a rough representation of the spectrum and the light intensity of the sun. Then I've got in blue the kind of region which amorphous silicon, so amorphous solar panels, are more sensitive around this area. And that is because the materials which are being used there actually require photons with a higher electron voltage, higher energy, and that means they're more sensitive around this area. Whereas you can see I've got in red your mono and polycrystalline panels. They are certainly sensitive to the viewable light that we see, the spectrum, but they peak around the kind of more 700 nanometers. As soon as we start going into the infrared region, that is where they peak, and then it kind of drops off. So they've certainly got two parts of the spectrum where the one panel is more sensitive than the other. So the interesting question I pose then is, which panel is going to enjoy the best benefit of this light band, if we're looking just in the visual parts of the band? And as it turns out, the amorphous panels benefit, because most of their sensitivity is in the visual light that we see. And in fact, that is one of the reasons why things like, let's say, solar-powered calculators, which are used indoors, make use of amorphous solar panels. So on this little calculator, you can see over here, this little window, there's a little amorphous solar panel stuck there. Now, there's two reasons. One is that amorphous solar panels are potentially, it depends on what material you're producing them on and with, they are cheaper to produce. You can also produce them in your own shapes and sizes. Whereas the traditional monocrystalline panels, the silicon wafers, the manufacture process is different. And in fact, with monocrystalline, they are grown in ingots. So you've got a specific form. Whereas the amorphous ones, you can manufacture to the form that you want. But in particular, these are more sensitive to visual light, which is what you get indoors, so they actually work better indoors. It's not because of low light, and we're going to cover that in a moment. It's because it's the bands, the spectrum of light that you see indoors, amorphous panels are more sensitive to that. Now then, if we've got a normal crystalline panel, so if we take, let's say, this monocrystalline panel, and I expose it to light in the area, let's say lower down, let's say it's more sensitive around the 700, 800 nanometer area. Now we know that the photons here have got less electron volt energy, whereas the photons down in the blue and the UV spectrum have got higher electron volt values. They've got more energy. So from what we've learned, if you have one of these panels exposed to the light down here, is it going to produce power? Well, yes, it is, because it's going to have more than enough energy from those photons to kick the electrons from the valence band into the conductance band. However, there's going to be a byproduct of heat which does add inefficiencies to it, but it'll produce energy. Now, what happens if we take an amorphous panel and we only expose it, let's say, to light at 800 or 900 or 1,000 nanometers? Well, there we can see a potential problem, because those photons aren't going to have enough energy to go and kick the electrons out and make an amorphous panel work. So that might explain why things like monocrystalline and polycrystalline panels end up being more efficient, because they can produce power across a broader band or spectrum of light than something like an amorphous panel. But let's see how that plays out when we do some practical demonstrations.
Alright, well, before we get to part two of that right there, I wanna play this deal right here. Let's see if I can find it. Anyway, halogen lights, they work a little bit differently than other light bulbs. So I got this video. Hopefully it's what I'm looking for. Let's try it.
This is a halogen lamp. Together with its incandescent cousin, it's the largest volume of lamps sold today in North America. Although incandescent and halogen lamps are giving way to newer and more efficient sources, such as LED, they still represent an important light source and something worth learning about. Halogen lamps are named for the gas that fills the inside of the lamp. This is an example of the capsule that's actually inside the lamp itself. Halogen lamps are slightly brighter and whiter than their incandescent cousins, but they essentially work the same way, by heating up a filament until it glows or incandesces. Halogen lamps enjoy many benefits, most notably the warm familiar color that flatters complexions and skin tones. Another benefit is the ease and simplicity of screwing in all of these different lamps into the same socket. Very, very flexible in that respect. That also allows us to put them into simple light fixtures, such as this track light or this recessed down light. And, equally important, halogen and incandescent light sources can be easily dimmed, making them flexible as well as adjustable in terms of light output and color tone. On the other hand, halogen lamps have a number of drawbacks, the most significant of which is their inefficiency. They use much more energy than more efficient light sources, such as LEDs or fluorescent, and as a result, are being replaced in many commercial and institutional applications.
I got to pause that for a second, because years ago I did a video called Vacuum Spark Gap, where I took a burnt out incandescent halogen bulb and was able to get that thing to light up. And I also did it with a regular tungsten element light bulb as well. And so with that said, that was using a Beckett oil burner igniter using 20,000 volts to use that frequency, that high voltage frequency, to literally leap across that burnt up element and get them hot anyway. So where in, you know, the standard way of using these light bulbs might not be as efficient, the intensity of the light and the capability of being able to dim or brighten this light could be a good research tool in trying to find the best spectrum and the best amount of lumens or light that you can get to energize these solar panels. So halogen imagine if you had a solar panel that was actually built into a system that could use the white light that halogen can put off And, you know, you could actually raise and lower the light amount of it. So you got a light inside of the actual solar panel built into the system. You got this gas impregnated into the solar panel. These are just, you know, thoughts outside the box, obviously. You know, take testing and stuff like that. But using all the different concepts and all the different technologies available, including fiber optics and the way that we can refract light and all these different things put in together, we could build incredibly efficient solar panels. And using supercapacitor technology as well, be able to do what Laser Saber was doing without near the amount of battery technology that we'd have to be able to come up with as well in order for storage. So using a combination of batteries and supercapacitor and regular capacitor technology, we would be able to store a lot more power a lot easier than we would have otherwise. And one other thing that was crossing my mind during this whole entire deal was actually the types of materials that we got. We have the capability of producing massive amounts of voltage using static electricity type of materials that have a what's the doggone word I'm looking for. I can't even remember. I'll have to look it up while this guy finishes out what he's saying.
Where they were once used. Halogen lamps, because of their inefficiency, also give off a lot of heat, making them uncomfortable, especially in confined locations. And they don't last very long, just a fraction of the life of an LED lamp. This makes them inconvenient and expensive to maintain. Given their advantages and their drawbacks, halogen lamps find their primary applications in homes, where we're familiar with them, and in hospitality spaces such as restaurants, where their dimmability and flexibility allows them to set different moods and atmospheres, so important for that application. Here are some of the most important types of halogen lamps you're likely to see. How about the simple, ordinary A lamp that fits into table lamps and so many different light fixtures? Once upon a time they were incandescent, today they are halogen. For display lighting, we have PAR lamps, or for a smaller, more flexible light source, NMR16. The capsule itself can be used bare in landscape lighting, and we have a variety of decorative and display lighting types as well.
All right, so that gives you a little bit of idea on halogen bulbs, drawbacks and all that kind of things. But because of the type of light and the capabilities of those bulbs is the reason why I wanted to bring that one up. The word I was looking for is tribal electric. Different materials have... there's a scale out there on tribal electricity. I will actually... post this link to Wikipedia article on it into the super chat room and over there People for People. But the reason why I was bringing that up is because we could build really incredibly efficient static generation machines using wind power and be able to use that to supplement the same system, kind of like what I was doing with the Free Thinkers video. And so that Free Thinkers was actually pulling static electricity every time the wind was blowing and other things were going on out there in the atmosphere. He was actually getting a static charge that was actually pumping voltage into capacitor banks. And I know I'm throwing a lot of stuff out there, but I'm throwing it out there for a reason, because one of these technologies by themselves might not be everything you need, but if you take and combine all these things together, you have a system that now will produce energy no matter what's going on outside. If it's raining outside, if it's windy outside, if it's sunny outside, if it's cold outside or hot outside, if you understand the basic laws of physics and science and how we actually generate power and use this energy to get work done, voltage is pressure, and so you know if you can produce a lot of voltage, you can pressurize capacitors and charge batteries and stuff like that. And so adding all this in together, then you can build a self-contained system that will be pulling power from every single direction that you can imagine, including radio waves. So let me see if I can find that next part two one in line. There it is. Anyway, there's a lot in these videos about light spectrums, and if you could track down the exact light spectrum that was what it took in order to get that solar panel to do the work to produce the electricity, even to the extent that there's a possibility that radio waves or different types of energy, radiant energy in the environment could actually, even during the nighttime, help to put power into those solar panels by re-engineering these things to do all of what I've been talking about. You'd have a solar panel that would work day or night. So let's get this going here.
Hello YouTubers, and welcome to part two of this tutorial series on how solar panels work. So we're going to have a practical demonstration showing how a light can affect various solar panels or materials, but I thought we'd just quickly start off by having a look at the physical construction of solar panels so we can get an understanding of how that works. So if we go and recap from part one, with a solar panel, you're going to have a construction material which keeps it all together, and that could be a frame, it could be sandwiched in glass. This one I've got here in my hands just happens to be set in resin, but you're going to have some kind of then backing material, and then a backing electrode, and that will be the positive electrode underneath. For the most part, as I said, there are some manufacturers who are doing different things now, so we'll have that positive electrode at the back. And then you're going to have your P-type silicon material down on your cell. And then you're going to have a very thin layer of N-type material. And that's going to form your P-N junction, which, as I noted, sets up your charge. And then on top of that, you're going to have thin electrodes, which is your negative connection, so that those pick up your electrons, which are being kicked out from the P-type material and then pulled out with a charge in the P-N junction, and then you've got your N-type on the top, and that is going to allow you a flow of electrons, which is then going to be your electricity and ultimately the power which is being produced by the solar panel. So what we want to have a look at then is to see how that's actually constructed. We've got these little individual cells which are all joined up. We're going to look at a couple of solar panels to see how that's put together, and then potentially some pros and cons with that construction method. So here I've got a solar panel which has got a fairly traditional construction. It's got an aluminium frame, some glass in the front, and then a backing on the back, and then a terminal to pick up the positive and the negative, which will come out to your power source. Then sandwiched between the backing and the front glass, we've got individual rectangular cells. Now these ones happen to be polycrystalline or multicrystalline, and if you have a look at it closely, if I hold it like that, hopefully the camera's picking it up, you can see it's got a slight blue tinge to it. And under certain light and certain panels, you can actually see the little crystalline structures on the individual cells. Now the multi or polycrystalline ones are actually produced in square ingots, whereas the monocrystalline silicon wafers are grown in round ingots. And that's often why you see in certain solar panels, and I'll just give you a rough representation here. This happens to be sun power, so it's not the best, but certainly the layout is the same. These are monocrystalline, and because they are grown in round ingots, what they end up doing is chamfering off the edges to try and get as much of the cell packed into a smaller space as possible. Now, in the very first solar panels, you'd actually see they'd use a half moon, half of that ingot, and they'd put them in, but that was very inefficient in terms of space. So if you're looking at a solar panel efficiency for the space or the unit area, it wouldn't be that high because you've got these big wide areas in between where you haven't got cells producing power. And ultimately, if you want to have your efficiency up, you want the highest efficiency cell crammed into as small a space as possible. You will, however, see that some monocrystalline panels, and here is one of them, they'll have more waste, not have the chamfered ends of the kind of diameter of the circle that it was grown in, so that they can cram as much as of the cell in as small a space as possible. And if you have a look at this color compared to the color at the back here, the monocrystalline panels tend to be dark, almost kind of black in color, compared to the blue hue, or sometimes very light blue hue, that you'll see in the multicrystalline cells. Now, each individual cell in this solar panel over here, you can see there's a rectangular cell over here. So that is one cell, and each cell is capable of producing about half a volt. And if you look carefully, if we go from the bottom end of the solar panel, you can see that we've got a cell over here, and here is this electrode running across all of these, and in fact it's going in series through all of these cells to connect them together in series. And if we have a really close look at this cell, you can see the individual fingers or conductors going across the top of that N-type material, which is a very thin layer on there, to go and pick up those electrons as they are released. So those electrons are picked up through all these conductors. They then come to this central conductor over here. They're then going to flow around. This is the negative terminal. They're going to flow around, power go through the load, come back through the positive, through the backside, and then recombine. And then, of course, if they're kicked out by photons again, that whole process continues, and that's your electricity flow. So herein lies the little interesting piece, or the one challenge with these solar panels and the way they're made up. I'm going to point this out when we get to an amorphous panel. Is that because you've got all these individual cells connected in series, if you have one of these shaded, it potentially blocks your current flow for the whole of the panel. It's not going to totally stop it, but you only need a small amount of shading on one of these panels to have a dramatic effect on the power production. So another interesting thing here, if you go and count all of these individual cells which are connected up, there are 36 of them. 36 divided by half a volt is going to give you 18 volts. Now let's just have a look at the rating. If we have a look at the rating for the solar panel, you'll see that the open circuit voltage is around 21.8 volts, but the actual voltage when it's producing power is around 17.3. And the reason it's sitting at around 7.3 is there will be some losses. There will be some series resistance in the circuit where there's going to be some voltage drop. So you're not going to get the full voltage potential of all these cells being connected together. There's some loss, and that's what the rated voltage for this panel is. If we take a look at an amorphous panel, now amorphous panel would be counted as a thin film panel. There are lots of different types of thin film panels. I'll show you another type that I have here. So it's also very dangerous to make assumptions about thin film panels in terms of their performance and what spectrum they're sensitive to, because the various thin film panels can be doped or made up of different materials, which means their sensitivity to the various bands of light or wavelengths of light is going to be different. But as I noted, these solar panels can be produced to almost any shape or form. Here you'll see you've got the cells are actually these long individual lines over here. And you're going to have the electrodes picking up the junctions. The type of junctions in an amorphous panel is slightly different to a mono or polycrystalline panel. But here you've got these cells situated like this. And that means that the performance of an amorphous panel when it gets shaded is actually quite different. And in a subsequent video, I'll actually put this underneath the grow light, both panels, and demonstrate this to you. But if you've got some shading going across an amorphous panel like this, you're not completely covering up one of these cells. So all of these cells are going to be linked together in series, but it takes a fair bit to cover one cell completely. So if you have partial shading, you're not going to completely cover up one cell. So the loss in power on one of these isn't as dramatic as it is on a mono or a polycrystalline cell, where you've got the small cells which can be eaten.
We'll pause that again for a second. He's talking about how you've got one bit of shade over one half of the solar panel. You know, it can make it where it's not producing as much. But we actually have materials and technology where we can equally distribute that light, no matter what, even if you had half of it covered up, using almost the equivalence of what fiber optics and prisms do. We can make the glass that goes across the top of it to where it will equally distribute that light across that entire solar panel. So that's just another piece of the puzzle, that if you added that type of technology in there, you could get these doggone solar panels to, even if half of it was in the shade, it'd still be pushing out power because it would still be able to get that light.
Easily covered up by a small bit of shading. Here I've got a SIGS solar panel. So this was an experimental one that I happened to buy off eBay because, again, I wanted to test its performance. There's all kinds of interesting claims which inevitably I've not seen them live up to. But this is a SIGS solar panel. It's another form of thin film solar panel. And here you've got individual strips of material which end up generating the power. So these have been laminated together and are laying down on top of each other. And we've got a terminal connection over here, and I'm assuming this is the positive going to the underside. These are lying on top, and I think the negative terminals are on the top there and are connecting in series to each other. So these are all series connected by lying on top of each other to where they get to the top here, and then you've got your negative connector over here picking up the other side, and then that's carrying off the current to a connector box on the underside. Then here is the sun power cells. Now the sun power cells, I know they've got a whole lot of patents on the way they produce their cells. They have some of the industry's highest rated efficiency for single junction solar cells. They have got cells now which are producing in the order of about 24%. Obviously, 24% is at a cell level once you and that's not having it connected together in series, having series losses and connector losses. I think you get roughly 22% efficiency from some of their solar panels. But at a cell level, they're around 24-25%. Now, the one interesting thing you'll note here, it's funny because I've mistaken these for thin film panels, especially when you see them in other configurations. It looks like an individual thin film, but these are actually monocrystalline wafers. But what they've done something very different with the process. I've not seen this mentioned in one document in particular on their site. I haven't found it, but I happened to read another paper which didn't name the cell it was talking about as being a sun power cell, but I realized from other bits that they were describing it was a sun power cell. But what they've gone and done, as opposed to having the two silicon layers right on top of each other, so having your, let's say, your P-type and then your N-type sandwiched straight on top of each other, apparently they've got it set up like a polka dot. So they've got the one, and I forget whether it's the P-type or the N-type. If I remember, I think it's the P-type. They've got it in polka dots coming through the cell. So as opposed to having the cell completely covered, they've got it coming through in polka dots on here. And that means they don't need those electrical connections on top of the cell, which means they've got more of the cell exposed to the sun without having those electrodes on the top, which is blocking the sun from the cell and therefore the efficiency. So that's one way they get far better efficiency, because they've got no electrodes on the top. That N-type or P-type material, which is coming through to the front, goes through to the back, so that you've got both your negative and your positive connectors at the back of the cell and nothing on the front. Now, the one place I've seen this in a more obvious fashion was, in fact, when I went to NASA. They've got cells there, and I know that SunPower have produced some cells for NASA, and NASA have used SunPower cells in the past. But now I'm talking about cells which have been used on the space station, which is orbiting the Earth. Those are about roughly 30 years old, and I've seen that same kind of technology used there, but more obvious. I'll try and insert a little photograph here, but you can actually see there's like little circles on the cells and electrodes poking through from the back. So as opposed to having electrodes running across the front, picking up your electrons, they've got literally electrodes, obviously a positive backing, and then I assume a negative, poking through to the front in just a small little spot to pick up the current, as opposed to something running across the front. And those are, that's technology from 30 years ago. But it certainly seems that SunPower have perfected that and got a much better solution. But if you go to their site, they do disclose some of the things that they do to make their panels more efficient. But it's certainly, I want to do far more testing with them. In fact, as you can see with these folding solar panels that I'm testing, most of these manufacturers now are moving to the SunPower cells because they know they're far more efficient.
Right, so next we're going to go and demonstrate how various materials are sensitive to various bands of light. And what I'm going to be using is LEDs. So I've got some LEDs. Now, I'm showing you on purpose, I've got some of these normal looking LEDs which have the kind of outer shell which is colored. It's got a filter there. Now, ones with a filter are no real good for this test. You want ones which are clear. Now, I've demonstrated previously in a TFD video I think I did some time ago. Sean from South Africa kindly mentioned this to me and I went and demonstrated it. That although an LED can produce light, it emits light when you add current to it. If you shine light into it, it can actually produce a bit of power. And that's because a light emitting diode is a diode. It's got a PN junction, just like a solar panel. And that PN junction, when you expose it to light, will do exactly what a solar panel does on a very smaller scale. Now, I'm not going to show the power production, I'm just going to show the voltage, because the power production is so small under the lighting that I've got. But an indication of the voltage level, whether the voltage level is sitting at a high level or low level, will indicate what kind of power it could produce. So that's what we're going to do. I'm going to note up front, the equipment that I'm doing this test with is not the best. Proper scientific equipment to do this kind of testing costs thousands of dollars. But I'll go into that as we get into the testing. Now for the practical demonstration, some of the things we're going to be using are a UV light, an infrared light. I've got a floodlight here, a cheap floodlight, which allows me to change the LEDs through different spectrum colors with this remote. I also have my spectrometer, which actually shows us the various spread of the spectrum. So if I hold this here, you can see there's certain spikes. It's picking up the LED lights above, which have got certain spikes in the spectrum. As I change it to the window, you can see the spectrum becoming far fuller as opposed to the kind of spiky spectrum it's going to get from the LED lights up over there. And this will allow us to do two things. One, it's going to allow us to see, of course, where in the spectrum the various light sources are, and then the intensity levels as well. Now, why is that so important? And I was caught off guard with this playing around, because when you're looking at something like a light source like this, your eyes tend to be far more sensitive to, let's say, the green wavelengths of light than other wavelengths. So it's very difficult for your eyes to judge intensity or how bright a light is. And in order to conduct these experiments properly, in theory what I should have is a light source where I can change the spectrum that it's at but maintain the same intensity. Because if I want to see the kind of effect, the photoelectric effect that has on a solar panel or the LEDs that we're going to be testing, ideally I want the intensity to be the same. What I'm going to show you is that the intensity is different. I've gone and noted that. And we'll take that into account when we do the testing, because it's still going to yield some interesting results. Now, can you do this at home? Yes, you can. Just be very careful. For one, if you're playing with UV lights, UV lights can be very dangerous. That's why out in the sun, and you probably realize now, UV has got the higher electron volt. It's got more energy, and that's why UV light is able to cause skin damage and cancer.
but it can be also dangerous directly using it in the lab like this. So just be careful. I'd say if you want to play around with this, play around with normal colored lights and get yourself some clear lens LEDs. So why clear lenses? If you go and use lenses which have got the normal colored filter on there, that is filtering the light and having a direct effect on what you're doing. Because if I go and shine, let's say, a red light into the green filter, it's going to mess up the result. Whereas if I've got a clear LED, then that's allowing that light source in there, and we can make some calls as to what's happening. Now, the other interesting thing we're going to talk about, and that's why I've got all these LEDs wrapped together, is multi-junctions. Because we're talking about, let's say, one particular material being sensitive to one band of light. But what if you put various materials, two or three materials, or four materials for that matter, inside a solar panel, so it was had multiple junctions, and it was sensitive to a broad range of light? Could we get more power out of it? So that's something we'll talk about as well. So the first thing I'll just demonstrate is this little Chinese floodlight that I've got that can do kind of RGB and a whole lot of colors in between. We're only going to concentrate on the key colors. Now, the reason I want to show you this is that you can get compound colors. So if you know, like mixing paints, if you mix two different color paints, you can come up with a compound color. Now, if we have compound light, for instance, if these colors aren't truly red or truly blue or truly green, we're not going to be able to conduct the experiment properly, because the materials aren't interested in compound light. They're going to pick out the true prime colors, and we want to see that we've got the true prime colors, and then also note, as I said, the light intensities. So if I switch this on white, it's combining a whole lot of colors to give us a white light. I can go to red, we've got the green, and then we've got the blue. And we're going to see how the different materials, so the various LEDs that I've got, and then solar panels react to that. We've also, as I've said, noted we've got the UV and the infrared light. So here we go. I've got the spectrometer sat on top of the LED light. I'm going to now switch it on to a white light. So something very interesting here to note, if you have a look, so this is upside down, but you can see it's showing us we've got the spectrum. There's obviously something in the red part of the spectrum, the green, and the blue. And that's exactly what we've got here. We've got all those lights combining to kind of give us a white light. But it's obviously not true white light, because it's certainly missing a fair part of the spectrum. But another interesting thing I want you to note, you can see how the intensity levels are dancing around. So that is the challenge that I faced with some of this experimentation and testing, is that this is a very cheap light source, a proper light source with which can maintain a consistent intensity and cost thousands, tens of thousands of dollars. But nonetheless, I should be able to demonstrate some bits and pieces for you. Now, if I switch this over to red, we can quite clearly see there we've got the red band. So that is the red LED. If I switch over to the green, you can see we've got some yellow in there, some green, and even a little bit of blue. And then if I go to the blue, you can see we flick over to the majority of that spectrum being blue. Now, what I want to also show you, if I go and switch over to another tool, which is going to show us kind of color rendering index and lux, and also the kind of peak wave, the wavelength at which the peak part of the spectrum is at. We want to have a look at intensity. So that's a lux. So if I go and switch on, we go to red, and we can see it sits around 22,000 lux, roughly. If I go to the green, we see it sitting around the 50 to 53,000 mark. If I go to blue, we can see that drops right down to roughly the 6,000 mark. Now, I've gone and made a note of these, but I just want you to note that there's certainly a big difference in intensity. I've actually gone and noted from a previous testing, and obviously this was placed differently, that the blue was around 5,000, the green was around 50,000, so 10 times more as intense, and then the red was around 22,000. So the green was the most intense, and then we had the red, and then the blue. I've also gone and made a note of the UV and the infrared lights, and those are very low on intensity. The UV light sits at about 16,000, and the infrared only sits at around 0.7 or 700 lux. Okay, so for the first test, what I've got my spectrometer here, particularly so we can actually measure the lux or the intensity. That'll give us an indication of the intensity of the light that's coming off this multicolored floodlight over here. I've got a red LED sat with its lens pointing down, directed at the light source. And then I've got the Fluke multimeter in the background, which will measure the voltage. Now here, what we first want to see is get an understanding for one, that it's going to, a voltage is going to be produced by this LED when we start shining light into it. And to see how that changes perhaps when we've got an intensity change in the light and a different band of light. Just to show you it's a red LED, I'm going to switch over to the diode check. And as I do that, you'll see that the red LED is actually illuminated. We can see it's showing a voltage drop across it of 1.7 volts, and that it's got that red illumination. Now, what I've done from the top to try and rule out some of the issues which are going to crop up in this testing, because there are going to be many, I've got the lens focused down, and you can see I've got the focal point of light coming out of the LED down at the array, the Cobb array of the LEDs in this floodlight. So if I go and change that, you can see I can change where the focal point of that LED is, and I've tried to kind of centralize it roughly over the center of that, the array of lights down there. There we go, I've got the light roughly in the middle. The spectrometer is going to read differently because I've got it set off to the side, but it's going to be consistently at the side as I change the light source. So now I'm going to switch over back to voltage. The LED obviously goes out. We're going to be measuring voltage. And if I switch on the red, I know it's going to be a bit disruptive with this in the lens of the camera, but hopefully you can see there, we're just below 1.6 volts at 1.599. I'll just double check the position to make sure we're getting the maximum. So there we go. The lens is obviously very sensitive in terms of the focal point, so I've gone and adjusted and found roughly its maximum 1.61. And the thing to note here, you can see the lux level is around 12,000 roughly. Now I'm going to switch over to the green. Now remember, the green was about roughly double the intensity. So if I go over to the green, we can see the voltage has dropped to 1.56. And if I bring it in and we have a look, I know the light is going to be very disruptive. The lux level is at 30,000, close to 31,000. That is more than double the light intensity, but the voltage is lower. And that will just show us that once we've gone and moved off where this LED has got its most sensitive spot, it's not producing as much voltage as it was previously. If I go to the blue, we'll see the voltage drops right down to 1.1, close to 1.2 volts. But here, the blue intensity is far less. That's right down to about 3,300. But all I'm trying to show here basically is that both intensity and the wavelength of the light will have an effect on the number of photons being emitted and the voltage level. So let's change it up to another LED and see what happens there. Now I've gone and attached a green LED. I'll just demonstrate that. I'll switch over to the diode test. If I go to the diode test, you can see we've got a green light being emitted. You can see the voltage drop there is around 2.8, close to 2.8 volts on the multimeter. So now we'll go back to measure voltage. I noticed I just moved it slightly. Now I'm going to switch on the red LED. So we'll start off with the red LED in the floodlight. Something I want you to note on the multimeter, barely a change. So I'm actually going to switch off the light. That's the voltage reading, kind of 0.0007, 0.0024. So hopefully now you'll realize that the wavelength of the light definitely has an effect. We've now got a situation where the photons being emitted by this red light don't have enough energy to kick the electrons from the valence band to the conductance band in this material inside the LED. Now I'm going to go to the green. Bang. And as soon as we go to the green light for this green LED, look what we've got. 1.6 volts. So even though the red light coming out of here is at a lower intensity, it's at half, it should certainly produce some voltage level on the meter, not nothing. But that is because of the photoelectric effect and the fact that the photons coming off from the red light, that wavelength of light, didn't have enough energy to kick the electrons out and get it flowing, whereas on green they have. Now let's go to blue. And just remember, here we're sitting at 30,000 lux. Look at the light intensity. It's dropped down to a tenth, 3,300. But look at the multimeter. 1.8, close to 1.9 volts. So the interesting thing there is, why is the voltage so much higher? Now, of course, I did note that the E voltage or the energy of blue light is going to be greater than green light. But that doesn't mean that you should get more electrons produced or kicked out. The side product is actually heat. So things become more inefficient. So why is this green LED managing to produce more higher voltage with this blue light? So let's see if we can perhaps uncover what's going on. Okay, so what I've gone and done to see if we can unearth what's going on, I've got the green LED pointed right into the spectrometer over here. So we can read the light, the type of light or the wavelength of light coming out of the green LED. So I'm going to switch over to diode test. You can see the green LED has illuminated. And the important thing I want you to note is here we go, we've got the peak, the wavelength of the peak coming out of this LED is sitting at 531 nanometers. So that is the wavelength, 531. So if we go and have a look at a chart, we can see that 531 is of course sitting in the green area. So now what we want to do is we want to go and see when we've got our light source switched on to both the so-called green coming out of this floodlight below, and then to blue, what wavelength of light are we getting out of that? Because obviously anything which is sitting higher up the scale on this side of 531 isn't going to help, because the photons coming in aren't going to have enough energy to get electricity or charge flowing or to get a voltage level, whereas obviously wavelengths below that will. So let's go and set up for that. Right, so now I've got the green LED switched on the floodlight, and I've got this switch switched into the mode where we can see the spectrum of light, and it still shows us the peak. Now remember, the LED, the peak, or the area that the LED was putting out, where it's going to be most sensitive, was sitting at 531. This, the peak here, is sitting down at 443. Now I want to say down here, because down at that area, those photons of light won't have enough energy to generate or free up the electrons to generate a charge or a voltage for us, or electricity. So in fact, you're going to move the pointer right down to kind of over here in the spectrum to get to the point where you get to roughly 531. And that's kind of more like half or less than half of the light coming out of here is going to have enough energy to develop a voltage in that particular LED. Now let's switch over to the blue. Now if we go to the blue, and we can see the peak of the blue is 428 nanometers. Most of it is sitting, or just about all of it is sitting higher than that 531. So even though this isn't the most efficient light, because some of the byproduct of this will be heat, all of it has the energy and capability to free up the electrons in this green LED, and that is why it's generating a higher voltage with this blue light source versus the so-called green that's coming out of the floodlight. Now I've got a blue LED attached. I'll just demonstrate that. If I go to the diode mode, you can see there's the blue light being emitted. It's showing a voltage drop, although I'm not sure, I forget what the fluke puts out, but it's showing 2.6 or close to 2.7 volts for the drop on that. I'm now going to go back to DC voltage and line it up over the floodlight. Okay, so everything is set up. Just a reminder, I'm going to start with the red light. Remember that the red light roughly sits at about 20 to 23,000 lux. The blue sits at about 50, so double the red. But the blue light coming out of here is only sitting at around 5,000. Now, those measurements are going to be different because this is set off a little bit, but you'll get a rough idea. But the intensity of the blue light in here is far lower than the red and the green. So let's go to the red. So I switch on the red, and you can see voltage level virtually doesn't touch. Let's just switch off. So the voltage level sitting there, if I go to the red, virtually nothing happening. I go to the green, yep, there's a bump up there. Now, if you recall, when we looked at the spectrum of the green on here, there is a little bit of blue sitting in the spectrum that's coming out of here. We haven't exactly got a pure primary green coming out of here. Now let me go to the blue. Bang, there we go. And if you have a look at the voltmeter, we're sitting at 1.2 volts. So why not as high? Because the intensity of this light isn't as high as those other light sources. So we'll just go back and double check that. You'll see we're measuring about 3,500 lux. I'm going to go to the green. Jumps up to 33,000. The red is around 12,000. So hopefully that just demonstrates to you again. So if we're looking at the voltage level as I change the light, you can obviously see the reflected light, the red virtually doing nothing. The green is producing something because there's a little bit of blue in there. But once we hit the blue, we can see that this LED is sensitive to that. The photons in the blue light source have enough energy to kick the electrons in this and get a charge going for us. And that hopefully merely demonstrates that various materials have different sensitivity to the various bands and wavelengths of light. Okay, and for fun, we're going to play that out at the extreme ends of the scale. So here I've got an infrared LED. I've got it set to the diode test just to pass some current through it. If I go and put this in front of the spectrometer, although there's some other light leaking in there, you'll see that we've at the top end is where we've got our peak, and that's at around 750 nanometers. So that's in the region of infrared. I've got an infrared light source over here. It's very low intensity. It's a tenth of the UV light I've got. It puts out roughly 700 lux. I'll switch it on. You will just about see some light source coming out of it in the camera. And just out of interest, the light source, we'll just check it where the peak of that is. And if we have a look at that, just try and catch it so you can see it on the camera. If you have a look, it is around 760 nanometers. So that's actually sitting higher up in the spectrum, which means those photons have got less energy. But there certainly will be some which are around the 750 mark and below. I've now got the multimeter set to voltage, and as I bring that light source up, there we go, you can see I'm producing about 0.8. If I get it in the right area, there we go, just over 0.8 volts coming out of that infrared LED. I'll now pull up a UV light. This UV light has got about 10 times the intensity, so no guesses as to what's going to happen here. Well, I say no guesses, look at that. Even though it's got 10 times the intensity, it's still not able to pull up the amount of voltage that that infrared light could. And that's because I imagine, and again, this is just going on the theory, and in practice I presume it's the same, because you've got photons with far more energy than is required, you're now getting losses due to heat, which counteract the charge that's being produced. But in another video, I'm going to go a little bit deeper into that so you can understand what happens when you get heat on a solar panel. So let's move over to the UV LED. So here we go, I've got the UV LED. You can actually see that light source coming off as I've got it on the diode test over here. Just out of interest, if I put it on the spectrometer, you can see there's a nice peak there, almost spot on 400 nanometers. So that's right nice down in the UV area. Just out of interest, if I get the UV light source, there we go, you can see this UV is sitting even lower, 379, 380 nanometers. The photons coming out of this light have a lot of energy, and of course we've got a fair bit of intensity as well. I'm now going to switch on the light source, and we've got the voltage reading on the multimeter. If I go and place it in the right place on one of those LEDs, you can see roughly up to about 2.6, close to 2.7 volts coming out of there. Now let's see what happens if I put the infrared light in front of it. Here's the infrared light, and hopefully by now you'll probably guess what the result's going to be. Even though this has got low intensity, if I put it in front of there, just about nothing. The photons coming out of here just don't have the energy for the area where this LED has its sensitivity. Right, so let's have some fun with solar panels. I've now got a monocrystalline panel sitting on the floodlight. We're going to measure its voltage. You can see it's already put from the light inside the room. It's managing to produce some voltage. Now, if you recall from the first video, I mentioned that in particular mono and polycrystalline panels, they certainly are going to be sensitive and work, as you probably now understand, the photons of light, right down from the UV spectrum going right up, have enough energy for the silicon to produce current flow. Because remember, the silicon is sitting at 1.1 electron volts, which is up in this infrared area over here. And of course, the electron voltage level increases as we go down here. So a mono polycrystalline panel is going to be able to produce, have enough energy from photons from light right across the band over here. But they are more sensitive up in the red infrared area over here. So let's just see how that plays out, bearing in mind, obviously, I've got different light intensities. If I go switch on the red, we're getting 6.2 volts. We'll just make sure it's kind of roughly in the maximum area. If I go to green, now remember, the green light from this floodlight has got double the intensity. Double the intensity, but you can see the voltage actually dropped. We're going to go to the blue, and the blue has only a quarter of the intensity of the red, or less than a quarter. And that is able to produce a nice level of voltage because all that light has got more than enough energy. But of course, as I mentioned before, there will be inefficiencies with potentially heat being generated. But nonetheless, even with this low intensity light, it's able to produce a good voltage. If I switch that off, and I now get the infrared light, which has very low intensity, and I plonk that on the panel, you can still see, even with this low intensity, and it doesn't have full coverage on the solar panel, it is able to kick out 5.9 volts. This is the very high intensity UV light, and you can see it doesn't produce as much. So we can certainly see this panel, the mono and polycrystalline panels, certainly do have their photosensitivity up more to this region. Now we'll try an amorphous solar panel. I'll place it on top of the light source. Bearing in mind what we're expecting to see, and I say here, we're going to do some testing later on, because I think you'll find that there are amorphous panels which, they're depending on their doping, might be sensitive to slightly different regions of the light spectrum. But now we're expecting this light to be more sensitive to this bottom end, the blues and the UV area, versus what the monocrystalline and polycrystalline were sensitive to. So I'm going to switch the red on, bearing in mind that the red intensity level is sitting at around 22,000 lux. We've got 11.3 volts. We're now going to go to green, which has got double the intensity. Right, it's gone to 11.4. Now we're going to go to blue, which is only 5,000 lux. So that is a tenth of what this green is. Bang. And what do you notice? That is where we are getting our highest voltage, even though it is a tenth of the intensity. Now, when I talk about the intensity on this remote, I can change the intensity level, and it has a dramatic effect. If I just turn that down a little bit, you'll see how quickly the voltage level starts dropping off, and I'm only dropping the intensity of this blue light a little bit. So for this amorphous panel that I've got, you can certainly see that the sensitivity lies around the blue and the UV area versus the mono polycrystalline. Let's just see how it reacts with the UV and the infrared light. Right, so now I'll get the infrared light, and of course we know the intensity level of this light is fairly low, and of course there is ambient light around, but nonetheless, I'll just stick it under the here, and we can see it doesn't have a dramatic effect at all. In fact, the ambient light is probably having more an effect versus what this infrared is. If I now get the UV light and put that on, bang, you can see the dramatic difference. But of course now we're dealing with different intensity levels. But hopefully the experiment with the floodlight down here demonstrated where this amorphous panel is sensitive versus the mono polycrystalline. And now to end off the testing, I want to throw a spanner in the works. I've now got another amorphous solar panel. So as you can see, it is an amorphous solar panel. This is also an amorphous solar panel, but a different wattage. But nonetheless, I've got it on top of the light source, and I'm going to start again at the red end. So there we go. Look at the voltage. 8 volts. Green, 7.2. Now I'm going to go to the blue, which is where the other amorphous solar panel was able to produce most of its voltage at a far lower intensity. And if I go on to that now, bang, 4 volts. Now let's use the UV light. While I have the infrared, I've got the infrared, and of course with the ambient light, that's not playing much of a role. We can see we're only around 2.5. And now I'm going to pull up the UV light, which you saw on the previous panel, where it was sensitive, and look, it's hardly having any effect at all. Certainly some. I don't have an answer for that, but what I want to highlight, and this is something I've realized through some of the white papers that I've been reading, a lot of people when they do their testing make claims about amorphous panels, let's say, working better under low light conditions, and then I see other papers contradicting that. I've never seen an amorphous panel work better under low light, and this is something we're going to end up testing as we move through this series. But what I want to highlight is the risk is that not all amorphous panels are the same, and it's very difficult and very dangerous perhaps to make a claim and generalize about amorphous panels when they certainly seem to have different sensitivities to different bands of light between different solar panels. Because in some of the tests I've seen, people just take one amorphous panel and base their assumptions on how they operate just on that one amorphous panel, which I think from the little testing I've seen can be very dangerous. So there you go. I hope from those practical demonstrations and that theory in the front end, if you only take away one bit of information, is to perhaps realize that certain materials, in particular the materials which are used in solar panels, are sensitive to various different bands of light or wavelengths of light. Certainly, it can be very dangerous even for me to try and draw conclusions from the testing that I'm doing on the bench. There are so many variables which could be impacting what I'm doing, and I could be drawing incorrect conclusions. But I've tried certain testing over again, tried to eliminate a reasonable amount of the variables, have reasonable test equipment, and certainly from what I can see, it's very interesting to see where perhaps a monocrystalline panel will perform well, where an amorphous panel will perform well. Once we get to some other testing, I'll demonstrate how under ambient light, the amorphous panels perform extremely well because they're getting all the bands of light that they need to operate from artificial lighting. Whereas these solar panels, which are far more efficient than amorphous solar panels, lack the kind of reds to infrared side where they're more sensitive and they get that out in the sunlight. But anyway, if you're interested in seeing more of these tutorials, please do consider helping me on Patreon, because that'll support the ongoing tutorials in this series. But I thank you very much for watching, and I'll catch you for the next one. Cheers.
All right, I hope that wasn't too boring for you. It's just that if you listen to what's going on in these videos and different tests and the different light spectrums, it shows that not only with some solar panels, even if they're the same brand, because of the way they're made, they might produce less under certain types of light. So if you could figure out, like I said, with the proper light spectrums, the best which ones of these will work on the best under which lighting conditions. That deal that I started off with earlier, where the guy was trying to light the light bulb using the solar panel. Once he energized the solar panel, it kind of the light kind of made a loop around. So, not to say that that video is real or anything, but imagine if you could actually do that. If you could build a solar simulator that would put just the right light spectrums, and even to the extent of covering the solar panel to block out lights that would be counteracted because they would generate heat, which would make that thing less efficient. If you could filter the incoming light to whichever the best light spectrum is, now you got an improvement on efficiency. And so he mentioned in there about temperature, and so I pulled up one of his videos that said how temperature affects the efficiency of the solar panel. So let's see what he's got to say on that.
Hello, YouTubers. Okay, now we're going to get into a little of the interesting testing of the solar panels, the monocrystalline and the amorphous panel. I've literally just gone up onto the roof above my little lab and attached two temperature probes, which I have attached to these two multimeters. The one multimeter you will recognize is my Fluke 287. And then the other one is a cheapie I've just gone and bought. It's a MagicTech MT22, and I'm sure there is a CEM equivalent, which I'll look up. I'm going to do a review on this. I was a little bit disappointed with the previous MagicTech that I did a review on, but this entry level may throw up a few surprises, but that will leave for another day. Anyway, the idea is basically I can monitor the temperature of both the panels up on the roof. We're in kind of the midsummer now in South Africa, and this is where I'm hoping to see whether the amorphous panel is going to have any advantage over the monochrome panel. I wish I could log both temperatures, but my Fluke, at least I can log and record the temperatures on the monochrome. It's the end of the day at the moment, which you'll see is why they're cool, fairly cool. I've got my Fluke 43B actually now measuring the power, direct power from the monochrome. And as you can see, yesterday it was a bit of a cloudy day up and down with the power. Today I had a cloud-free day, so a nice clean graph of the power that came through. And over the next couple of days, weeks and what have you, I'm going to keep a track on how the temperature affects things. We'll just pop outside quickly, because I just want to show you another part of the testing which we're going to do. Okay, so it's the end of the day, so I'm having to hide here, or the sun will be shining directly into the camera. But basically, you can see there that black cable coming out from the corner of the door has got the two temperature leads in it, and they've been stuck to the back of the panels. We're first going to start with the panels in the up position. They're sitting at roughly 45 plus degrees, or anyway, I suppose between 35 and 40 degrees. Now, in this situation, the monochrome on the left-hand side should have the advantage because it's going to be cooled. And the amorphous, which should work better under warmer conditions, is probably at a disadvantage. So we're going to look at that for a couple of days, and then I'm actually going to drop them flat onto the roof. And it's a metal corrugated roof. So on a hot summer's day here, it's going to get fairly hot. And we'll start recording the temperatures and see then if the amorphous panel has any advantage. So anyway, if you're keen to track that and see which has the advantage, then certainly do subscribe and follow this series. I'm hoping once we've eliminated one of those panels, because unfortunately I can't get three up at once and I can't record the power of three, I'm going to get a polycrystalline, because I think a 55-watt polycrystalline will give the monochrome a good run for its money. And certainly in South Africa, it would be different in Europe and in the States, northern part of the States. But in hotter, warmer climates, the poly probably has an advantage, but we'll put it to the test and see if that is the case. Anyway, thanks for watching, and we'll pick up on the series very soon.
All right, so that's the beginning of his series. I jumped straight to number four to see what he has to say about what was the efficiency of it. Let's
see what's up. Hello, YouTubers. I thought I'd just post this video because I've had quite an interesting day doing a little bit of research on the polycrystalline solar panel. One that Seth Solar gave me. I took it off the roof and I did some testing with it, and today is an extremely hot day in Cape Town. The ambient temperatures are here locally anywhere between 30 and 35 degrees Celsius. There have been recorded temperatures in Cape Town of close to 50 degrees, so it is an extraordinarily hot day today. What I did find out after doing a bit of research, the polycrystallines apparently will actually, their performance will actually drop off during the heat. The monocrystallines will start producing power earlier, i.e. at lower light, so at your tail ends of the day that the mono will do better, and it does better in the heat. Now this kind of contradicts some of the findings that are found in Cleveland, Ohio. But obviously the weather conditions there are very different to here. I was also told by someone, which kind of reaffirmed what I found in Cleveland, that a polycrystalline should perform better in the heat. But I'm going to provide some links in the show notes, which will detail something different to that. Now, to go back to the performance of the Set Solar panel, I've been just doing some maths and just kind of working on some figures. I still think there's probably something wrong with that panel, but there might be another reason. If the heat apparently, that once a panel reaches 50, 51 degrees, and this is, now we're talking about a mono, it potentially can lose 12 to 15% of its output. And the loss on a poly is even greater than that. Now here I have a 50 watt polycrystalline panel which I purchased in the States. It's made by CDT. And this was producing when I connected wiring up locally to it, because I was testing to make sure there's no losses in the wiring that I had from the roof. This was producing about 41 watts, and the Set Solar panel was producing about 43 watts. Now, I did some maths, and what could have happened here, I'm still not saying there's nothing wrong with that, but what could have happened, today my mono is producing around 53 watts. I reckon, and I've seen that produce in excess of 60 watts. I think I was just very fortunate in that the mono I received from Set Solar happened to be of a higher than standard spec, and that can happen. It can be potluck what you get sometimes. You can have a 2 to 3% difference, but I think that one for some reason just performs extremely well. So let's say it actually operates sometimes in the order of around 60 watts. If it lost about 12 or 15%, that would cater for the figure of around 50, 53 watts today. And let's say I have an underperforming 55 watt, and that lost closer to 20% because it would lose more under hot conditions. That would potentially cater for it running around 43 to 44 watts. Now, as I said, I saw 43 coming out of this today, roughly at the same time my Set Solar mono was doing 53 watts. So that could be the case. I'm trying to find things to justify its performance, why it's performing the way it is, and that's what I came up with. I'm still going to give Set Solar a call and perhaps take it back. Just out of interest, I measured the area of the silicon on these, and the 55 watt is...
Sorry, the video quality of that. He's standing outside. It's windy in the microphone. But anyway, the temperature of those solar panels affecting efficiency. There's a lot of videos out there that talk about how to cool your solar panels down. And so if you sit back and you look at the big picture of how the physics of everything works and everything you've heard from and what colors of light cause the most heat and which ones are the most effective, then you can take and pick out the best portions of those, filter out the colors of light spectrum that you don't want that are going to cause more heat, and only allow in the light spectrum that you do want. And so with that said, even to the extent of cooling them down or moving that energy away using thermoelectrics as well, I go back to the Free Thinkers video where I'm pulling power from every single direction just to prove a point to everybody that no matter what's going on, you'd be able to have power going into your power banks and in charging your batteries with, and then, you know, to the extent of how you actually use that energy on the way out as well. And the reason why I keep talking about high voltage and static electricity and all that kind of stuff, you combine all these things in together and you get a system that will literally push power no matter what's going on outside. So, going back to the guy who was running the solar panel off of the lights, I know for a fact that ambient light on solar panels will produce electricity. Whether or not, you know, forget about the fact that the light that you get at the top, on your ceiling or whatever, it takes more energy than you're actually getting out. That's not the point. It's the point is that you can use ambient light to get power out of these. So if you could build a really efficient lighting system like what Laser Saber was doing with that one particular circuit, jewel ring circuit that he was doing, it didn't take as near the amount of power to produce that same amount of light. And so if you can improve on the efficiency of how you're actually generating that light, you can improve on the efficiency of how that solar panel as well. So all these things taken in consideration, all these factors and all the technologies put together, being able to understand how light actually refracts, what the best light spectrums are, you could build a solar panel that one of which if you needed to keep it cool to make it more efficient, you could run a thin layer of water across the top of that solar panel, and then that would take away the heat of the solar panel, but at the same time allow that light to be able to equally distribute almost like fiber optics across the top of that solar panel. So a solar panel in the bottom of a swimming pool, would it run better than a solar panel, the same exact solar panel, out in direct sunlight? So those are all tests that could actually be done to see whether or not the heat is making a difference. And even, like I said, even if the heat is causing it to lose efficiency, there's ways of which you could take that heat off and then turn that heat back into electricity as well. So I'm going to be doing a lot of experiments behind the scenes, and whenever I come up with the perfect combination, which I know I can, the Free Thinkers video, basically the Free Thinkers series, there's several videos on there, and I kept asking the question what people think it's for. And hoping that I'd get the right response. But anyway, so I'm going to do some experiments behind the scenes. When I get the right combination, whether it be a combination of LEDs and Peltier elements and heat sinks and whatever, I'm going to try to show exactly what I've been trying to explain to you today about, you know, why I believe that it is possible for the guy that was trying to run the solar panel off of a light, so it's looping around, why I think that that's literally possible. Sorry about all the coughing. It's some sort of catch in my throat. It's changing weather. And so, with that said, I think I pretty much covered everything. And, like I said, I hope this video, I hope this this show wasn't boring to you, but it gives you some idea of, you know, these different concepts about how solar panels work, temperatures of, you know, efficiency, that kind of stuff like that, and what Laser Saber did by building a solar panel all in one unit. It's got the charge controller, it's got the inverter, it's got the battery banks inside there. And I actually think he sells a kit on how you can actually build one of those if you want. But nonetheless, I don't just look at one thing by itself. I add all these possibilities together, all these anomalies. That's one of the things about my YouTube channel. When you see these videos, and I'm showing you something that's really important, it's a piece of the puzzle. I get these wise guys that say, well, that ain't going to run my house. It costs you more power putting in than you putting out. I'm not saying that you're going to run your house off of any one of these anomalies by themselves. What I'm saying is, the effects, the physics, the mechanics of what's going on in this video is important. It's important to take all these pieces of the puzzle, put them together, if you're going to build a free energy device that's going to be able to work, literally, using the laws of physics to your advantage, you need to understand a few things. The Seebeck effect in thermoelectricity. You got two different types of metals. And when you heat one side of it, as long as there's a temperature difference between those two different metals and on the opposite side of it, the Seebeck effect will continue to work. Dang it. Then it'll generate power. Let me take a drink of my coffee here. And you'll generate power. But the moment both sides of those get to the same exact temperature, that effect stops. The same thing with a Peltier element. The concept is the same exact. If both sides of that Peltier element get to the same temperature, then it stops. The Seebeck effect stops. So if you can keep a constant imbalance from those with natural temperature differences, like, for example, you know, on the floor as opposed to a heated room, or one of them stuck to the window pane when the sun's beating outside and you got the AC going on inside, there's always going to be a temperature difference. And so that will keep that electricity flowing. And so, taking all these things in consideration, the technology we have, transistors, diodes, you know, MOSFETs, 555 timers, the way that we can pulse circuits, the way that inverter systems work, and storage. We have every single thing necessary to build a perfect, efficient machine. If we can get the dream team together in a shop, taking every bit of what we know right now, less than 30 days time, I'm telling you, you've got exactly what it is you're looking for. You got exactly what it is the world said that they needed. They said we needed clean, renewable, alternative energy. They said we needed to reduce our carbon footprint. Of course, you all know how I feel about that. They said there was a problem. They said there was an energy crisis. Wars over oil and ridiculousness, all that kind of stuff there. It don't matter, you choose a subject out there, whether it be the internal combustion engine, solar, wind, static electricity. We have enough knowledge right now to pull power from every possible source imaginable simultaneously and give the world exactly what they said they wanted. Doesn't defy any of the known laws of physics. It uses physics to your advantage. We know what all the best types of fuels are. We know how to produce different types of fuels, biodiesels from a vast number of sources. Things that the oil industry don't want you to know, things that the electrical industry doesn't want you to know, things that the governments don't want you to know. Shazia's mad science is bringing it to light, and I'm putting it on the table. I'm ready when you're ready. I'm ready to get it done. I got my new lab on the way. It's looking really good. Still got some things to work out. But once I get that lab up and running and start pumping videos out again, I guarantee you it's time to get serious. I tried to put information out there in a creative way in order to get people to run with ideas and see how, you know, I could get people motivated towards doing what they said they needed to do. I come across a whole lot of criticism, mocking, ridicule, hatefulness. People out there believing that they were smarter than they really were, they misquoting the laws of thermodynamics. A constant headache. Things that would make the most folks just up and walk away. No matter what I tried to share with them, the thumbs down kept coming, the cursing and the ridiculing and the insults kept coming. The closer I got to pointing out what it is I've been trying to share with people for quite a long time, the harder the system kicked back. YouTube promotes people that fake stuff. They promote fraudsters. They censor everybody and his brother who they disagree with. You can't talk about climate change, climate disruption, or global warming without them putting their little label under there to try to give their version. You can't have a free thinking forum without them trying to intervene and try to convince somebody that you don't know what you're talking about. I'm somebody who paid attention in science class. I do know what I'm talking about. And I'm ready to give the world what it is that they said they wanted. The question is, are they willing to accept it? I took every bit of their physics, I took every bit of their science, and I took common sense and mechanics and everything that I could possibly study and muster in order to be able to come to the conclusion that I am telling you energy is free. Now, I don't care about a reputation. I'm not in this to get rich. I'm not in this to get famous. I told the power company that I was going to dedicate the rest of my entire life to studying everything that there was to know about alternative energy. And when I got that accomplished, I was going to share it with each and every one of their customers for free, and I meant it. So when their wallet gets thin, they're going to have me to blame. So, with that said, you have all the tools. You have all the technology. You have the knowledge. You have the capability to re-engineer and recreate things and make them so incredibly efficient. And with my new lab and showing you a different type of generator that will use electricity in a more efficient manner, if you go back and you peek through some of my videos and you see what I've been trying to show people on storage, the amount of power input, the anomalies that come about, it'll all fall into place. Every single bit of what I'm telling you, by the time it's all said and done, you won't just know it works. You'll know exactly how it works. And empowered by that knowledge, you can help others to build those same doggone machines. Or take whatever machine that needs to be more efficient and understand how that machine works and be able to engineer it to take what otherwise would have been a waste and make it into something positive. Everything from the way that we treat our trash, our garbage, wasted energy. My hopes is to show the world how to become so incredibly efficient that it will be irrefutable and undeniable that energy really indeed is free. So I'm really excited about getting this lab together. I got a few more things to work out. I got some finances to get in order. And once I get that lab up and running, it's time to get real. So chances of me doing some crazy videos in order to show you what it is that I've been trying to show you probably going to be a little slimmer than prior, because before I had to test the waters. Now I don't care about testing the waters because I already know what I'm up against. I'm going to give the world exactly what I said I was going to do, and you can take that to the bank. You mark my words, you heard it here. Folks, you've been listening to Mad Science. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'm not done yet. I'm only getting started. So, I hope you stay tuned. And when you get this information that I'm fixing to dump out there into the world, I hope you share it with everybody and his brother as fast as humanly and physically possible. Because the moment I open Pandora's box, that's when you're going to see the crazy. Peace and love, everybody. You've been listening to Mad Science. Take care.
Says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, my woman and the kids and the dogs and me. Got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Because when them old boys raised on shotguns, came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies.
And we can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, 'cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. And we can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh.
One ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I've got a laptop, baby.
I make music with my friends.
He's got a laptop, there he is. He's got a laptop.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.